Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News, and we're going to start off with Stephanie Ellis from WildCare. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
So this is the time of year where lots of people see baby birds. They're not sure what to do, and they either call or bring them to you. So what should people be doing if they're seeing baby birds in their yard? When is it important to bring them to you?
Sure. So if you see baby birds in the yard and they're obviously injured, or, you know, if your cat has had them in its mouth, that's when you want to call us, and we're probably going to have you bring the bird to us. When you don't want to bring in baby birds is if you see what we refer to as a fledgling, which is, a fully feathered young bird. It would be on the ground most times. And if you watch from a distance, you'll see the parents feeding it. And so these are the rambunctious teenagers. They can't fly yet. They don't have their flight feathers fully in. And so the parents are feeding them on the ground. And so what we usually recommend is to watch from a distance. And I'm pretty sure that you'll see the parents feeding them. And that's a bird that you want to leave alone.
Right. And we also are seeing other little baby squirrels and other little babies. And you tend to them as well.
We do, yes. We take in all species of wild birds, reptiles, amphibians, and small mammals. So mammals up to the size of an opossum we will see in our emergency clinic.
We should say, and then Cape Wildlife Center takes some of the bigger animals that you do not, right?
That's correct, yes. So I feel like wildlife is well covered on Cape Cod because the Cape Wildlife Center in Barnstable, they take also birds, reptiles, amphibians, and they see all the mammals, so including the large mammals like coyotes, fox, skunk, otter. So it works out really well. We often have a swapping of animals and resources.
Yeah. So Stephanie, are you full at WildCare right now? What have you got in the center right now?
I'd say we have over 70 or 80 patients at the moment. So we are getting incredibly busy for this season. It's mostly orphans, so we have a lot of baby birds in our nursery incubators. It's also been a banner year for rabbits. Mm-hmm. So eastern cottontail rabbits, I think we've received over 150 this season.
Wow.
And again, that's with, we have a helpline. So we're on the phone with people, and we try to prevent kidnappings anytime we can and encourage people to put things back. So baby rabbits, opossums, we even have baby mice. It's crazy baby time.
What's the helpline?
Our helpline is, we operate that from 9 to 5 daily, and the phone number is 508-240-2255.
All right, we'll put that.
Encourage people to come.
Yeah, we'll put that up on our website, capeandislands.org, so folks have questions, Stephanie, they can give you a call. Thanks so much for joining us last minute this morning. We appreciate that.
Thanks. You're so welcome. Thank you.
You bet. Mark Faraday is here, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. That's busy over there. I bet it's just as busy over at Cape Wildlife Center.
I would imagine, yeah. It's a tough time of year. It's like accountants and tax season when it's spring for people dealing with baby birds. And always good to hear from Stephanie. That was good. But, as someone who's in charge of a garden, I have an idea of what to do with some of those rabbits.
Do you wonder what's a weird thing?
They're absolutely killing me, and they're not native.
No, but I'm knocking on this formica because I don't want to jinx myself, but I have rabbits in my yard, and they're so well-behaved. All they get into is my clover. They don't jump up into beds.
Every situation is different, and if you have a lawn, like a proper lawn should have clover in it. Hopefully you don't have one of these chemically maintained lawns.
No, I have a very organic clover lawn.
Right. It should have lots of clover. Mine is all clover, and it's nobody put it there. It just sort of...
And
the rabbits eat the clover and stay out of your garden.
That's what's happening.
But at the sanctuary, I spent the last 2 years redoing our pollinator garden, and some of the plant you can't have them in there without a fence. I've tried different repellents and things, but they just take it right down and kill them. Dozens of plants. Yeah, and they're not. And the eastern cottontail is not native to this area. It was brought here. Our native rabbit. I would guess almost nobody listening has ever seen the New England cottontail because they're very rare. Mm. They're endangered with a small e. They haven't been formally listed, but they're in very, very few places like the military base. And, mm-hmm. But
we just brought a bunch over to Neshan, I think. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. That's been in the news, and that's great. I mean, they need some help. But the rabbit you see in your backyard was not native to New England, the eastern cottontail.
Right. Yeah. All right, 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. Maybe you have a question or a story about birds, 866-999-4626, or other animals. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so the weather's been pretty nice of late. It's feeling a little more like it kind of went from sort of spring right to summer almost, right?
Yeah, right. It was sort of like cool and rainy is one of those classic Cape Cod springs. A little too cool, a little too rainy, it seemed at times. But, you know, we had our spring days here and there. You know, spring fell on a Tuesday this year. but, yeah, it's you know, seems like we're headlong into summer now. And even today, cloudy, rainy day, it's going to be mid-70s. So, summer's here.
And we're still seeing some winter straggle. A snowy owl in Chatham, it's got to be. Don't you think it's got to be the same one that was in Falmouth? I mean, how many snowy owls could there be around here?
So I'm dying to get photos. And so this didn't come through the usual birding channels. I was reading some, you know, weekly, kind of half reading some weekly report about nesting shorebirds in Chatham. And I mean, very carefully reading this work related email. And I saw this comment from this week's report. It was like, no sign of the snowy owl this week. I was like, wait a minute. And I went back and read the report from the week before about, you know, nesting plovers in Chatham. I saw that there was a snowy owl on South Beach. And I guess none of the crew or birders, it didn't come up on eBird or anything like that. I'm hoping somebody got photos and we can see if this was the same bird that was in Falmouth, because that bird disappeared as far as I know. I haven't heard anything about that.
So if somebody in Chatham is seeing that snowy owl, let us know.
Yeah, and this is a new thing. I mean, this didn't used to happen, summer snowy owls. You know, there was a record from several years back. Norm Smith of Mass Audubon, who's the king of snowy owls, been researching them for a million years up at Logan Airport, had a July bird that was there into July at Logan Airport in Boston. But that was always such an anomaly. And now it seems like every year, like Great Island in Wellfleet, you know, Monomoy, South Beach, there's a snowy owl for some reason that's staying down here and not returning to the Arctic, which used to be unheard of.
Yeah. And so some other rare lingering winter birds. We have some red crossbills. What else would we have?
Yeah. So this past winter was a fun one for these eruptive winter finches. Not all of which are finches, but mostly they are. And these are birds that we always hope for as birders and every winter, and you never know. And we talked about them several times during the winter. But they're birds that respond to seed crops, mostly treed seed crops, across the boreal forests of Canada and Alaska, places like that. And when those seed crops fail, and that includes conifers, you know, willows, mountain ash, which is a fruiting tree, then there's a suite of birds that will come south. And we don't see them every winter. Sometimes years go by for some of these species without seeing any significant numbers. And this winter was a really big one, especially for evening grosbeak. And that's a bird that hasn't been common in the winters really since the 70s and 80s is when they stopped coming down here anymore. There used to be a thing back then where the evening grosbeaks, these big, bright yellow, loud birds would descend upon feeders and eat all the sunflower seed. And then they just went away. And that wasn't a thing that happened for many, many years. And then this winter, we saw a good number of them, and people were getting them at their feeders. But they lingered. So,
it's a pretty sound.
I couldn't have told you what an evening... is that an evening grosbeak?
Rose-breasted grosbeak.
I was going to say, all right. We're talking evening grosbeaks here. It's like, I don't think that's what evening grosbeaks sound like.
But it's pretty...
right. Rose-breasted grosbeaks breed in Massachusetts. But evening grosbeak is a winter bird and essentially a non-entity really anymore. But this winter we had some. And then in Wellfleet, there was one still coming to a feeder occasionally as of a few days ago. And I couldn't find any June records for evening grosbeak. So that was significant. Yeah. And then red crossbills. I had a couple in my yard in late April and... somebody, Jeremiah Trimble, just had 8 in Miles Standish State Forest in Plymouth, where, you know, we suspect they breed sometimes, plenty of pines there. And so this has just been a very unusual winter, and it's turned into an unusual spring for these things. They're staying later than they typically do. Pine siskins, mm-hmm. Not very few June records of pine siskins. That's one of these winter finches. But there was just one. We were having an event at the sanctuary in Wellfleet the other day, and one showed up at the feeders.
How nice to show up during your event.
It didn't look well. I was going to ask Stephanie about this bird. If I could have caught it, I would have. It looked like it had like some sort of fungal infection or something was wrong with it. But yeah, so sometimes the birds are staying because they're not well. But so that was unusual, and some other people still have siskins at their feeders that I've talked to. So, yeah, it's just it's that phenomenon where you get winter clashing with summer. It makes for kind of an interesting aesthetic to be talking about snowy owls and red crossbills at the same time that, you know, it's in close to 80 degrees and the breeding birds are in full swing.
Yeah. Rich in T-Ticket writes, I have just witnessed two red-winged blackbird males fighting on the ground in our backyard. I would use the term tussling to describe the behavior, almost like boys in the schoolyard. First one, then the other on top, looking like they were pecking each other, flopping about. I stepped outside to get pictures, but this moved them off into an adjacent brush and leaves, so I couldn't capture the activity. Is this normal, and normal for what occasion? I've never seen this before, even though we have lots of red wings around.
Yeah, birds of almost all species are pretty pugnacious when it comes to territoriality, and male red-winged blackbirds are very territorial. It's important for them to secure a territory because once they do, they can breed with multiple females. And it's why the males come back earlier than the females in red-winged blackbirds. And so it's a big deal for them to secure a territory. And so if that's threatened, then it's time to throw down.
Right?
It's time for some kung fu fighting and everything. I mean, you look at the cute little piping plovers on the beaches. Yeah. And I mean, they will like try to drown each other. If you spend enough time watching them, they'll have these knockdown, drag-out fights. They throw the females around. We've seen them trying to drown other pairs' chicks.
Oh, wow!
If you watch breeding birds enough, I mean, they live in a state of nature, and it's hard out there. And sometimes you have to fight for what you have.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Cindy in West Falmouth writes, besides the many birds nesting in the yard, I have yellow warblers nesting just outside my kitchen window. I have a really close-up view through my spotting scope set up on the kitchen counter. I think the eggs were laid around May 27th, and I'm now seeing three fuzzy chicks. Both parents are constantly feeding them. My question is, when might they fledge?
About 2 weeks after they hatch. It was pretty typical for songbirds. Yellow warblers, that's cool. You must be kind of thickety and shrubby. They're not uncommon, but they like a certain kind of habitat. You know, they're not in the woods. They're in thickety, wet, shrubby. They like willows a lot. And they have their nests are sort of unique. They're very white. Like they put fluff, some kind of a fluff from some seed heads or something that they use in their nests. These little tightly woven cup nests, but they can be really dense and they seem okay with some amount of invasive species if it's just thickety and wet. But yeah, about 2 weeks, and then songbirds, that's all they need. It's like 2 weeks incubation, 2 weeks for the nestling period. That's good. This is a common question we get. You know, people call and say, I've got, something's nesting on my back deck. When is it going to be gone? And I talked to somebody recently who thought it was just they were going to live there for the whole summer. I'm like, no, if you're seeing chicks, they're going to be gone in less than 2 weeks.
And now you don't want to scare them away either. You don't want to go in there messing around in the bushes where they are, right? I mean, you don't want to be moving branches around and scaring the moms out.
No, I mean it's not catastrophic. I mean, I'm someone who's worked with songbirds for years, and yeah, we go in and check on nests and ban nestlings and things like that. I mean, they're not small amount of disturbance, occasional disturbance is not catastrophic, but yeah, I mean leave them alone for the most part.
I have a catbird nest in one of my big hydrangeas, and I got a great photo of the eggs in the nest, but I can't really see in there anymore because the leaves have grown in. So I've been leaving them alone, watching them come in mm-hmm. and out. And sometimes like I'll try to peer in between the leaves, and sometimes I can see mom's eye looking out. Yeah. But I haven't, I'm sure there are probably babies in there, but I'm waiting to see them start popping out.
Yeah, well, just check on. I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, we, you know, it's your yard, so you can kind of manage the comings and goings and
watch
make sure you're
out,
not flushing them. Don't flush them off the nest more than once every few days or something, like, you know, come up with some rules. But, yeah, I mean, when we manage nest boxes, you're checking them, and sometimes the bird flushes out, but it's just for 15 seconds and then they're back on.
Yeah. I'm really excited because we can see the, you know, from inside the house, we can watch the, you know, mom and dad, maybe, I don't know, but coming and going, the catbirds coming and going. So I'm imagine once those babies start hopping around, we'll be able to see them.
Yeah. Yeah. And some nestlings are loud. I'm trying to think of how catbird nestlings are.
I haven't heard a peep.
Yeah. They might be one of the quiet ones. The real loud nestlings are orioles and woodpeckers.
Oh.
I mean, the woodpecker nestlings never stop chattering from inside the nest cavity. It seems maladaptive.
Yeah.
Like they're worried that the parents aren't going to find them again. So they're like,
we're over
here. Don't forget us. Don't forget us.
And
but I would think they would alert the predators, but it seems to work because woodpeckers are common.
And now robins will have more than one brood. What about catbirds? Will this be it for them, or will they have another?
Do they
go to other nests, or do they keep the same
one? I don't know if they could be double brooded. I wouldn't think as often as something like bluebirds that nest much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if catbirds were double brooding a lot.
And what about the robins? Do they do a second brood in the same nest, or do they go somewhere else?
Typically, it would be in a different nest because songbird nests get really disgusting. if you've ever watched one in your yard, you see that at the end, if it successfully fledged chicks, I mean, it's full of poop and mites and you know, little flat flies that they get.
I think I'd want a new nest too.
Yeah. That's songbirds don't reuse their nests typically.
All right. Yeah. Let's talk to Don, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good morning.
Hi, I was working in my shed last week. It has a window, and I just happened to be looking out the window while I was working, and there's a small pine tree next to the window, and a very light green bird about the size of a blue jay robin size landed there and looked at me for a minute and flew away. And I looked up in all the bird books I have online. I can't find any light green birds.
Could be the way
just
the light
wondering
was,
what
too.
It could have been.
Yeah, I mean, the light reflecting off of leaves tends to make things look green. There aren't a lot of green birds, you're right. And the one
know,
possibility
I swear
is not
it was. Maybe I was thinking a wild parrot.
There's no wild parrots but around here. But the only green bird that occasionally shows up on the Cape is a female or young painted bunting that are kind of you know, it's a small finchy bird that is all
okay, no,
all
it was
green,
bigger than that.
Greenish.
Sure.
Yeah, no, there's nothing like that. That
all
I can
right,
think of. I would guess reflections off the leaves or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you see it again, get a picture done.
Yes.
It didn't stay long.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for the call. All right, Karen writes, what tide is best for watching migrating shorebirds next month in Chatham? Is it better if it is falling or rising?
Depends on the site. So I manage Tern Island, which is a well-known shorebird site. And people generally bird it from the mainland looking across the channel with a scope. And that is best on a receding tide, a couple, 3 hours after high tide as the flats open up. So there are places that are feeding flats where the shorebirds come in on the receding tide. And so often that's a good tide. But if it's really productive feeding flats that they like to stay at, then it can still be good at dead low and as the tide comes in. And there might be some sites where the birds stop off on their way back to a high tide roost on a rising tide where you could catch some. But I would say overall, kind of a mid-falling tide is often good, but it depends on what the flats look like and when they open up at a particular spot. And then other places are better at high tide, like back when before South Beach broke up into this treacherous archipelago of sandbars, South Beach and Chatham. It was the premier shorebirding place, probably in New England. And the shorebirds would be there sort of all the time. Some would be feeding there on the lower tides, but it's a high tide roost. And so a rising tide through the high tide, and then when the tide started dropping, the shorebirds get restless. They come out of their, you know, roosting mode where they're standing on one leg with their bills tucked in, and they start chattering, and then they take off and they go somewhere else in the system to feed for a while. So, it depends on the site, and knowing whether it's a high tide roost or feeding flats is helpful.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Since we're talking about fledging, all right, I drive by those osprey nests every day. When will I start seeing the little baby chicks' heads popping up? Are they eggs still now?
No.
Well, no, they're hatched?
Yeah, they should be hatched.
Yeah.
So look for that. You know, instead of being hunkered down, the classic where you can barely see the top of the female's head.
Mm-hmm.
There's the osprey. Yeah. The beautiful melodic song of the osprey. That's a great sound. But
they're pretty.
Yeah, oh, ospreys.
They may not have a pretty sound, but they are pretty.
It's so funny to think about how, I mean, the 70s was either a long time ago or yesterday, depending on how old you are, but there were none. You know, I mean, my childhood, an osprey, I would have lost it. But, you know, now they're all over the place, and it's nice. It's nice to see so many ospreys everywhere, and especially this part of the world is different than where I hang out on the Outer Cape, where... Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot more than there used to be, but we don't have the density that you guys
have.
We have
a lot,
and Falmouth-born, like this part of the world, is like osprey central. It's unbelievable.
So are we seeing, because I'm noticing that the adult birds are a little, they're not so much in the nest with their heads popping up. They're sort of standing on the sides. Is that
right,
because
I didn't finish my thought. That's right. So instead of being hunkered down in the nest, the female, generally the female stays at the nest pretty much all the time through incubation. She does all the incubating, and then she does all the feeding. The male does the fishing, and he brings back the fish, and, you know, he takes his part of it, and then he drops it off, and she feeds it to the chicks. And so you can see that happening. That's an obvious indication that there are chicks in there. But, you know, you start to see she's spending less time down in the nest. On a day like today, she would have to be, it's really raining right now, she would have to be brooding, you know, those chicks if they're young, because they're not very well feathered and can't thermoregulate. So when it's raining like this, she'd probably be looking like she's incubating.
Yeah. There's a telephone pole. I often see this osprey sitting on top, and I'm thinking it's probably dad, right? Getting away from the mom and kids hanging out there.
Yeah. I mean, he just like, he has what I guess would be some guy's ideal summer. He just sort of fishes all day, every day. And then
drops it in the nest, and goes and hangs out.
Drops back to the house now and again, drops off a fish and goes back to fishing. You know, has his little bachelor perch. He hangs out and, you know, he's got his man cave, his osprey man cave.
Yeah.
If you look closely, there's a big screen TV on his little perch that he, anyway.
All right. So Cape Cod Museum of Natural History, they do have a great osprey cam. And I guess there's three babies in the nest now. So if you want to go over and check that out, that's a good place to bring the kids.
Oh, Cape absolutely.
Cod Museum of Natural History. They have nice trails. That's really fun.
Yeah, right, great gardens. Yeah.
Let's talk to Carolyn in South Dennis. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
So we have a question. We have a bird feeder with oranges and grape jelly to bring back the orioles every year. It's our sixth year with them. And, of course, everyone eats it, the hummingbirds, the squirrels. And the other day I looked out, and there's a woodpecker, a female woodpecker, laying on her back on the feeder, feet up in the air, wings spread, eyes open. I said, oh, my God, I think she's dead. And my husband went outside, and she just flew away. I mean, was she having too much sugar?
Food coma. Yeah, yeah. You know, she crashed.
That's so funny.
I don't have a good answer. I only have joke answers. No, that's really not having seen it myself. It's hard to say. That is very strange.
It was shocking.
But yeah, they do. People tell me about woodpeckers visiting there, especially the grape jelly feeders and sometimes hummingbird feeders. And they have a long tongue that can get inside the hummingbird feeder. It's not something I see very often, but I hear enough about it to know that it's a common thing.
Yeah, maybe she's just, really? You know, enjoying that. She's like, oh, this is, I'll just take a, you know, lay down here and enjoy my grape jelly.
Wait, it's a common thing for them to lay down? Or for
No, I'm sorry. To visit these kind of sugary things that we offer,
well,
the hummingbirds.
Well, we have a humming feeder, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To it too, so that's a lot of sugar.
So when you say it was laying on its back on the feeder, which feeder?
Kind of half in the jelly.
Good Lord.
It's not quite. On the flat part, it looked so dead, but how it was balanced on there, I don't know. There really isn't enough space. And it looked like one of the feet was wrapped around the perch. And again, the eyes were wide open, and I just thought, how do you die like that? But it flew right away.
It would have died happy, I think. I think it was just blissing out. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, Carolyn, thanks for sharing.
It's a safe place to be.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Since we're mentioning hummingbirds, a lot of people noticing that all of a sudden hummingbirds are disappearing from their feeders. What's going on?
Yeah, I guess it is a real phenomenon, because I got a couple emails about this, and then I've noticed that my female hummingbird that was coming every day is gone, and usually very aware of her. I see her collecting nesting material at a certain point in May. She collects cobwebs from the forest floor just out behind my backyard. But then she just sort of disappeared. Then she came back, and she was sort of visiting the feeder now and again. And now I haven't seen her in a few days, and I've got a male who comes, you know, once or twice a day, and that's about it. And so there are a few things going on. First of all, a female hummingbird has to do all of the nesting duties herself. She doesn't get any help from the male, so she has to do all of the incubating and feeding the chicks. And so she might be incubating. The other thing is that there's a lot of other things. There's a lot of things blooming right now. And hummingbirds, they'll visit all kinds of things. And I'm really into native plant gardening and wildlife gardening and all that kind of thing. And then I look, and my hummingbird is visiting every flower on this autumn olive in my neighbor's yard. Autumn olive is like one of the worst invasive shrubs. It's covered in these little flowers. And the hummingbird's like, yes, please. Mm. You know, honeysuckles, they don't care. They don't need to have evolved with a plant to be able to get food from it. I mean, a lot of the plants hummingbirds visit are, you know, European plants.
Butterfly bush.
Butterfly bush is Asian.
And they love those.
It certainly didn't evolve with hummingbirds. There are no hummingbirds in the old world. Although I think there were. I shouldn't say that. I'm going to back off that, because I think there are some fossils of hummingbirds and things have changed. It may have way back in time. But it's not necessary to have. They just need nectar that they can get at with their bill. That's it.
So is it about time then now to take down the hummingbird feeders, or do you leave them up? I was going to take mine down because I have so much in bloom.
Well, I wouldn't take it down. No, this is unusual. No, I mean, I think it's very unusual for the hummingbirds to stop visiting altogether. I wouldn't take it down during the summer.
Leave it up? And how often should you change it, the water?
Depending on the weather. When I tell people to put them up in mid-April, you can probably leave it for a couple of weeks because it's cool enough then. But you don't want mold to grow. And if you see the mold, it's like way too late. And so, every few days, change it out. I have a little spritzer with some diluted bleach for when I'm cleaning it. Just, a little bit of that and rinse it out and fresh food and put it back out.
Okay.
But yeah, you don't want it getting moldy.
All right, let's talk to Karen, who's calling from East Ham. Hi, Karen.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question back to the bunnies.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I have basically a native perennial garden. But with all the success that I have heard that people had in previous seasons with planting annuals, a lot of zinnias, to attract the monarchs. And so that's what I have tried to do, the interplanting this season. However, it's just really been a losing battle.
Mm.
As soon as the seeds get to be that tender little seedling, they just get wiped out. Versus fencing, chicken wire or something like that, are repellents effective at all?
Yeah, there are some that work for a while that I've had good luck with. And yeah, zinnias are great. You know, there's nothing wrong with some annuals, and hummingbirds and all the different butterflies love zinnias. And I was trying to grow this Mexican sunflower, which is kind of zinnia-like. Mm-hmm. And the rabbits ate the seed. I tried sowing seeds directly into some bare spots in a bed, and the rabbits just,
What about fox urine? A lot of people swear by fox urine.
I was looking into that. I don't think it's that effective. So the thing that works, there's some products that are based on cow and pig blood.
Okay.
And so they're natural. They act as a fertilizer. You know, even if they don't work, it's not bad for the plants. There's one that UConn did a study of a bunch of different repellents where the control was total fencing. And then they tried all these different, you know, liquid fence and these other products that you see in your garden centers for repelling rabbits. And the one that worked almost as well as a fence was this obscure, hard-to-find product that you can order online called Plant Skid. Plant, S-K-Y-D-D. It's like Scandinavian. And it's really just, it's like dehydrated blood cells. And it's hard to work with. You have to reformulate it with water and a mixer, and it clogs the spray bottles. But it does work. But there are some garden centers that sell an expensive but much easier to use blood-based product called Rabbit Scram. Sometimes it's called Deer Scram. It's the exact same product. And it's just in a big shaker. And I've had really good luck with that. You just shake it around. But if you have a dog, like my dog then goes and licks the plants.
Yeah.
But it's got that certain umami he just can't resist. But it's blood-based, and it does work. You know, it's just like $40 for this shaker thing that, depending on the size of your garden, you know, won't go very far. But if you just hit, you know, if just certain plants that they're hitting, it buys them some time to grow bigger and put down roots and things like that. If you apply it every week or so.
Yeah, Karen, let us know how that goes if you do that. We'd love to hear how it works.
Well, I think I will, because actually the first seeding of the seeds is gone now. So I have, it seems to be, and now it's getting warmer, so I've tried a second seeding, which, you know, has not come up yet. Mm-hmm. And then I also thought I would try some, you know, the small transplants, you know, six pack.
Yeah.
So I've put them in between, you know, the areas too. So I think I'll invest. It's, you know, it's kind of a thing of money versus time and energy. It seems to be, you know, it might be something to try, and I'd be more than happy to let you know.
Yeah, let us know. Thanks, Karen, for the call.
Yeah, good luck.
All right, let's talk to Mark calling from Harwich. Hi, Mark.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Great.
Good
morning.
I was reminded when I heard your comment about the hummingbirds having a long tongue, that a few years back, when I was had taken out a slider off the backside of my house and had walled it in with plywood for some remodeling, and left a gap in the top that I filled in with some of that expanding foam. And shortly after doing that, one morning I heard a woodpecker rapping on the back of the house. So as I went to inspect that, I saw the bird tongue sticking through the expanding foam on the inside. And what it was a flicker. And the tongue was, you know, really long, and I couldn't help by observing the way it was probing around and wondering, do they smell their tongues?
Wondering, say that again? You broke up a little bit.
Do they smell with their tongues?
Oh.
No.
Yeah.
Their tongues are incredible. But yeah, they don't. Woodpeckers are not one of the birds that has much of a sense of smell, as far as we know. Used to be thought that no birds had a sense of smell. I think it was John James Audubon himself did some sort of poorly designed studies and declared that birds don't have a sense of smell, but some do. Seabirds, especially the tube noses birds like shearwaters, petrels, they have really good senses of smell. Vultures need to be able to smell those dead things on the rising thermals. But most birds don't have a sense of smell. But yeah, that's funny. It was looking for ants, probably.
Yes, this looks like a good spot right here.
Yeah.
All right, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. John is calling from Orleans. Hi, John.
Hi. There's one or more companies that have Cape Cod weed control or something similar. They spray lawns, evidently, to keep down weeds. Is that harmful to birds, please? Thank you.
Oh. Depends, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have an arsenal of chemicals they're putting on lawns for different reasons. The worst of them are the neonics. And, you know, we've talked about neonics, and they get discussed a lot because of they're known to be harmful to bees, and it's a systemic pesticide that gets into all parts of the plant, including the pollen and the nectar, and it persists for years. But I don't think a lot of people realize that people use neonics, some of them probably unknowingly, on their lawn for grub control. I don't think Grubex has it's imidachlorpid, I think, is the chemical. You can look this up. But there is a systemic neonic pesticide that gets commonly applied to lawns. And if you have clover on your lawns, it gets into the clover pollen and nectar and can affect bees. As far as birds go, anything that's just like eliminating all insects, like broad-scale pesticides, broad-spectrum pesticides, that's reducing the food source for birds.
But also, we don't want to get rid of all of. I mean, a broad thing. There's a lot of good insects that we want to keep.
It drives me nuts. And don't get me started on these companies. I mean, and I think people misunderstand that they're talking to an expert, and what they're talking to is a salesman. And so they'll get them to sign a contract where they come six times a year needlessly and spraying. You know, they're like setting your lawn up for chemical dependency.
And I have a suggestion for this. Yeah. I would say call over to the county extension office if you want to know, if you're trying to check out what chemicals somebody's are using or what's safest for your lawn. County extension.
Yes.
Boswell County Extension. They have so much information there, and I would check with them.
Absolutely check with them. And because what happened last year was the gypsy moths and the winter moths were under control.
We knew they
weren't going to be a problem, but the spraying companies were like, you know, time to spray the gypsy moths, and nobody needed to spray last year, and this year either.
Yeah. Check with County Extension. They can help you out with which chemicals might be safe and what's not so much. Joan is calling from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. Saturday afternoon, late, my dog and I were walking up the hill by our house and heard two birds calling. It was a sharp clicking sound almost, and then one flew off down towards Round Cove, and as it flew by me, I could see that it was a small hawk. It had wings sort of like a mourning dove, but a straight, long tail. And then when I got up to the top of the hill, the other one was there, and it was sitting on a branch, and I couldn't see any streaking on it or bands on its tail, but it was a very small, pale-colored hawk, and it had a long, straight tail. And it stayed there for several minutes until my dog decided it wanted to walk in that direction. And then it took off towards Kendrick Road and Wauquasset. What could they have been siblings? Because they were so pale colored.
It's a little early for fledglings of Cooper's hawks. Sharpshin hawk is pretty rare as a breeder, but it's possible. Probably where you are, it's more like East Harwich. Probably Cooper's hawk is more likely. The Sharpshin's like more extensive coniferous forest, and we're pretty oaky in East Harwich. But yeah, you could have seen it like a male Cooper's hawk flying off with prey. I don't know what the second bird you're talking about. It's hard to say. But yeah, this time of year, the Cooper's and Sharpshin hawks, they're in nesting mode. They're in stealth mode. They use the cover of the leafed-out trees, and they fly very low to the ground and pop up over fences to surprise birds. They're hunting birds, both of those species, and then bringing them back to their nestlings.
Right. So two rare warblers of different species kind of hanging out with each other in Mashpee. What's this all about?
Oh, it's a scandal. I mean, this is all over the bird tabloids. It's an interspecies dalliance seems to be developing here. And these are birds that are very interesting in their own right that birders have been lining up to see at Santuit Pond, which is usually not super well visited by birders. But when you get a Kentucky warbler setting up shop, which is a beautiful, really rare, around here anyway, southern warbler. And so people have been going there to see that. There's Acadian flycatcher there, which is another rare southern bird that bred in Mashpee years ago, but not since. And then people noticed this worm-eating warbler. And this was also typically a southern bird that has been breeding around Falmouth area for a while. So it seemed that this worm-eating warbler female was kind of hanging around this male Kentucky warbler, and they were acting like they were a pair. And it's bizarre for a variety of reasons. They're not even in the same genus of warblers, so they're not closely related as far as warblers go. They don't look anything alike. A worm-eating warbler is like this drab, kind of thrushy, you know, it's got stripes on the head, but it's like an olivey, dull-colored bird that probes in dead leaf clusters habitually. And then a Kentucky warbler is this bright yellow, loud singing birds. They're in the same genus as a common yellowthroat. They have this repetitive song. Yeah, you might mistake their song for a Carolina wren.
That's Kentucky warbler.
Good work. Yeah, that's good work, Dan. Yeah. That's So this is really interesting. I don't know what could come of this, but there's been all kinds of weird warbler pairings that have resulted in hybrids, like people that had to be figured out with DNA and things like that.
The birds will
surprise you, yeah.
All right, let's talk to Connie calling from Monument Beach. Hi, Connie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say I live in a Victorian Greek Revival house, and it has columns all around it with the flat capitals on top. And every year, there are three or four columns that the birds come back to because they make their nests there every year. Mm. And I assume it's the same guys coming back. One year, I was having painting done, and, of course, the painters, you know, tossed all the nests because they leave their nests. They come back, they refurbish them, and they just move in again, and they were shocked to find nothing. They're like, what? Where's our nest?
Yeah.
Yeah, where's our nest?
Do you know what they are, Connie? What type?
Well, I think they're little wrens. They have like a little ruby throat and chest, a little violet colored, and
house,
they're tiny.
House finches.
The purple is what they call the purple finch.
No, that's a different bird.
Purple finch is more rare. It's similar and closely related, but the backyard bird is the house finch.
Yeah,
and
they're very common. They
visit feeders. They nest in hanging planters and things like that. They like to be around. They're called house finch for a reason. Mm-hmm. That's my guess. And they're not using last year's nests. They might nest in a similar location.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I've had that happen where they nested in the wreath and then on top of the wreath and then in a hanging plant. Yeah, same area, but, yeah, different nests.
Same neighborhood, different house.
Yeah, let's squeeze in Paul calling from Sandwich. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. How are we doing?
Great.
Morning.
We have a bunch of eiders still in the canal here in Sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen eiders at this time of year. There's probably 40 of them, male, female, and immature.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, we do have eiders year-round in Massachusetts in different versions. So they breed like the Boston Harbor Islands and some Rocky North Shore Islands, and I think they breed in the Elizabeth Islands, or they did anyway. But most places we'll see a few non-breeding eiders through the summer. And it's usually first-year males is pretty typically what you see, and some first-year females, but to see full adult males would be interesting in the canal. There are some birds that for whatever reason are not breeding that we'll see different parts of the Cape and throughout the summer. Loons are the same way. You don't expect to see loons in the summer, but you might see a small raft of six or seven common loons on the ocean in mid-July that are birds that didn't go back to the lakes to breed for some reason.
All right, Paul, thanks for the call. Leslie writes, we recently had a robin's nest with four nestlings in our front door wreath. My husband had bought me a video watch camera so we could watch the eggs hatch and then monitor the nestlings. Our whole family enjoyed checking on them every morning. When my daughter went out to check them one day, The nestlings were gone. She went to check the video feed, figuring she would see them learning to fly. Instead, she watched in horror as a black crow picked each nestling up out of the nest and flew off. It was a very sad morning. If we had known to expect that, we might have put a net or something up to protect them. Don't know you'd be able to put a net up, would you?
No. Yeah. No,
it's a hard
Well, that's one of the reasons we're putting the metal cages around plover nests. I don't do that anymore because there's a risk that the adults get eaten at them, which is worse than losing a nest. But, you know, with some species, you can put something around a nest that allows the birds to get in and out, but you wouldn't do that for a robin nest. You take your chances, and birds are taking their chances. They're wild birds, and they're predators. And
as you say, it's a tough life.
It's a tough life, and it's early enough that they'll have a chance to re-nest. And birds will, you know, nests get eaten, and then the birds will do several more nesting attempts if they need to.
Yeah. All right, so we have about a minute left. I want to mention this orca spotted off of Cape Cod. This was amazing video. We don't often see orcas swimming around here.
No, that's really cool. I love birds, but boy, I would love to have been on that boat to see that
this
orca.
Is a,
that's
a fishing
rare
charter boat, right?
Yeah. Very cool. Yes.
Yeah. And this was off of Chatham. And
I love off of Chatham. Like, if you were standing on land, it was like 70 miles off of Chatham.
You had to be in the boat. But I guess it followed them for about 20 minutes in the, you know, in the break of the, you know, water behind the boat, playing with and swimming around with dolphins.
Hanging
I didn't know
dolphins.
That orcas like dolphins.
Well, they're a big dolphin, you know, sort of. Yeah. They're all toothed whales.
Yeah.
But boy, yeah, that's... a once-in-a-lifetime sighting, as they noted. And the fishermen were saying, I've been out on the water 30 years and never seen one. And that's a treasured memory for those guys.
Yeah, and there's video. So if you Google it, or I know a lot of people have shared it on Facebook, but fascinating to see. So All right, Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary.
That's me.
See you next month.
All right, we'll see you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.